Focus with Jessica Strutt on ABC Radio Perth.
The Japanese word ikigai roughly translates as the thing that you live for, that thing that gets you out of bed in the morning and pumped to seize the day. It might be holding your grandchild or throwing a line into the river to catch a fish, maybe tending your veggie patch. The people of Okinawa in Japan are some of the longest-lived people on the planet, and sharper minds than mine have figured out that ikigai is part of the magic that sees so many of them celebrating their 100th birthdays in tip-top shape. Here on Focus, you know, we've been doing this short series called Life in the Slow Lane. And the thread running through every episode, I suppose, is a rejection of life as an endless run on a hamster wheel, because quite simply, that's exhausting, and finding new ways to escape the rat race. And it might not mean doing it every day, but at least doing little things each day that help you to get beyond the rat race. Today, we'll meet some people who said to themselves, you know what, stop the world. I want to get off. And in throwing caution to the breeze, they found their ikigai. Yeah, I mean, sure, easier said than done, right? And today we'll find out what stops us from really chasing our dreams. And of course, I'd love to hear from you. If you would like to tell me about your big life change, the number 1300 222 720, or you can send a text 0437 922 720. With me today, Sarah Andrews, designer, masterclass teacher and Airbnb host. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
And Dr. Marnie Lishman, psychologist, is back to help explain what stops us jumping out of this treadmill more often. Sarah, we're going to start with you, though. How did you feel when you found yourself in a tiny village in Mexico?
Well, a bit shocked, really. It wasn't the plan. I'd been trying to sail around the world and I didn't make it. I ended up sinking quite dramatically and being pulled out of the water by the federales in Mexico, and then kind of stowed away in this little town because it was kind of a secret, because I didn't have a passport to get out of the country or a visa to be in the country. So their idea was they would hide me away until somebody could work out what the situation was. So that's how I got there.
What did you have when you found yourself shipwrecked? And I know you don't want to go into the ins and outs of that. I mean, it's pretty traumatic and I get that. What did you have when you found yourself in this tiny little village in Mexico?
I think, okay, so there's summary of things I had was a T-shirt, a pair of track pants, a life jacket, and a backpack, which everything had fallen out of except for a bottle of whiskey. So no shoes, no undies. I didn't even have a hair lucky or anything. It was not a huge amount of stuff.
Bottle of whiskey is a bit of a win, though.
I drank that one pretty quick. Plenty of tequila where I was, so that was fine.
Okay, so describe this place that you've landed.
So it was really, it felt like the ends of the earth, and it was. It had no real road going to it, just sort of a couple of dirt tracks from a main highway. Probably be a town of around 40 people who mainly kind of lived, I suppose. I mean, I couldn't talk with the locals that well because my Spanish wasn't that good, but
even after the bottle of whiskey.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of hand movements and drawing things in sand and things like that. But mainly just very just fishermen essentially, and kelp farmers that dried kelp and then sold it. So a tiny, tiny little place. Like, none of the buildings had all four walls or any sort of flooring. Very, very basic.
What did the average day look like? How did you get by?
Well, I sort of pieced together the story over the time I was there, because for the longest while I was in quite a bit of shock, and I wasn't really aware of what was happening. So the town had essentially, I think, adopted me. I was kind of like their project. And they gave me this little shack on the beach which had three walls and a roof and a fire pit out the front to cook on and a jug of water and a mattress. So that was my home. They lent me a cat to keep me company. But it wasn't actually a cat. It was kind of like this little mountain lion things. It was quite wild. But I spent my days foraging for food, so I didn't have any money. So I would wake up really early in the morning and go down to the reef and pull mussels off the reef. I would just walk around the village, just trying to talk to people and seeing what was going on. And I'd be invited to things like, you know, they had a baseball match on Sunday, and I would always go to church just because that was what everyone did, and I'd sit down the back and just listen in. I'd help old ladies make tortillas, and I swam. I slept a lot. I had someone in the town gave me the one book in English, which is a romance novel. So I'd read this romance novel over and over again because I was desperate for something to read, and everything was in Spanish. So those are sort of my days, which was quite blissful. I didn't really want to leave. I was very happy living on my beach with my cat.
So no technology here, very different to the life you'd had previously?
No, nothing. I think to get in touch with my parents, I'd have to go to the local police station, and it wasn't really a police station. It was like a little hut that I think once every couple of weeks some kind of official-looking guy would come and do paperwork. So they had a phone there. But there was certainly no, ATM or bank or anything like that there. It was on the Baja Peninsula of Mexico on the water. So it was very remote, you know, no postal service, nothing.
Were you surprised quite quickly by how little you could live with?
Yeah, the things I really wanted a camera. I take photos of my life, and I really wanted a bra. I was quite desperate to get some underpants, and there's no shops there or anything like that. And, you know, locals would leave things on my kind of almost doorstep, but nothing would fit because I was nearly double the height of any other lady in town. So everyone laughed about it, and you know, they all thought it was quite funny, this strange tall Australian that they'd adopted us, I guess.
We're back in the slow lane today with Jess Strutt, ABC Radio Perth, the Focus program. Back in the slow lane as part of that series we've been doing, Life in the Slow Lane, which is, I suppose, the first one I think was Thinking Slow, then we did Slow Food, and then we did Talk the Walk, which is getting outside, I suppose, and getting all those devices out of your ears and actually just being out in the wondrous world, in the bush particularly. Today we're looking at what stops us following our dreams and doing what we want with our life. I know you're all going to say the mortgage, but we're going to have a look at that later on. We've been hearing from Sarah Andrews, designer and master class teacher, and she's been talking about being shipwrecked, landing in a tiny little town in Mexico. And she got there. We're not going to re-traumatise you today because I know that being shipwrecked and this experience is, and I can hear that, that's hard for you to relive parts of that. But can we backtrack here to the years that led you to being stranded there? Where does that journey begin as, I suppose, something like in your 20s?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to put a finger on the start of a story, but I guess I started off my professional life as a very well-known scientist. I was working in London for a very big global organisation, working on some of the biggest projects in the world. And as such a young person, I was given a lot of responsibility and, people who worked for me. And I had what everyone works for, which is, you know, the career and the house and the fancy job, and but I was desperately unhappy and I wasn't quite sure how I'd very quickly ended up in that spot.
I think a lot of people listening today will identify with what you're saying.
Yeah, I think I was talking to a friend the other day and we were laughing about you know, felt really triggered by just thinking of, you know, water cooler moments and all the things that you have to do in an office, and thinking, oh my God, if I had to, you know, suffer through that, I wouldn't cope well. But
tick, 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 tick all those boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I ticked all the boxes and I was really unhappy. And I remember I had a boss who called me into his office one day and he said, you know, you're doing such a good job. One day you're going to be sitting in my office. And at that point, my whole life kind of flashed before my eyes and I quit on the spot. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't walk back in the office. I wrote them an email and just said, I don't know, like, this isn't the right way to resign, but I just cannot come back to work. So I sold my, I had a house in Australia I'd bought before I left, before the boom. Luckily, it was, markets were on the up. So I sold that and that gave me enough money, I think, to have a few years to think about what I wanted to do with my life, because at this point I was only about 22. So I just started, like, wandering around the world for a few years with no real aim except to find what it was I was supposed to do that would make me happy. And I didn't find it, but I had a lot of fun. But I always had this anxiety with, like, you know, I'm still not happy. You know, I'm doing the thing that everyone dreams of doing. I did the career thing. I got the house. Now I'm traveling full time. So the moment came when I was sitting on the bay in San Francisco and I just sitting there just miserable, and I was trying to ask myself, okay, you know, what is it that you want? And the answer was, I just don't want to be around anyone or anywhere or life or technology or, you know, society. I want to be so far away from that, but I didn't think that place in the world existed because I'd travelled everywhere and nowhere really fit that inner yearning I was looking for. And then a boat sailed past. I was like, that's it. That's what I've got to do. I've got to be at sea. I knew that's what I wanted to do. So
then what happened?
So I bought a boat and,
so you had a bit of the money left that you'd blown a lot of it, but you had a bit of money.
I've blown a lot of it. You had a bit left and I thought, well, I'll just, you know, at that point I was so desperately unhappy, you know. The unhappiness had compounded by the travelling, I think, because I did it and it still didn't make me happy. So I didn't think I had many options left in life. Like, I did the work thing, I did the London thing, I did the travel thing. None of it kind of worked, so bought a boat and bought the most beautiful boat instead of the most seaworthy, I suppose, which was fun. And I spent about a year getting ready and full time just learning to sail and learning to service my own engine and getting ready for this trip. And I took it quite seriously. So I would work all day at these things. You know, taking my engine apart, putting it back together, fixing sails, you know, learning how to sew up, you know, sutures in my own skin. And I was very prepared and very serious about this trip that I wanted to do, which I was very proud of myself for because I'd never really put that much effort into things. And then after about a year, I took off and with no real destination or time pressure, I would.
And alone?
Most of the time I was alone, and sometimes when I got lonely, you know, I think it's still going, but there was a website called Couchsurfing. So I would just put my profile up and I would get random travellers who were in the same area to come and live with me on my boat and then help me sail. And then when, you know, I wasn't lonely anymore, they would move off onto their next destination. So I had it's an amazing community at sea. I think it sounds surprisingly lonely, but you know everyone who's in the ocean around you. Everyone's in contact and you'll get to a port and everyone already knows you're coming because, you know, so-and-so had been there the week before and told them that you were going to be there. And there's this weird little community that's out there and I don't know how it works. It just does. So, I spent my times just relaxing on my boat, exploring lonely beaches, sailing around, I was young, so a lot of partying and drinking and meeting other boat owners. So it was for the first time I'd felt that happiness and peace, I think, that I'd been looking for. So it worked. I did the right thing. It was the right thing for me to do. Even though looking back now, it sounds like a pretty crazy pursuit at that age with that little amount of experience.
But you end up, as you said, shipwrecked. So you have this beautiful experience. You sail around. Life is fairly free. You're living this simple life after being shipwrecked. And presumably, I think you mentioned earlier, you just don't want to come home.
No, I was on the beach in Mexico for, I think, about 6 months. A lot of good things happened in my favour to keep me there. So it was around the time of swine flu, so all the embassies and things were shut. There was a lot of difficulty getting me out of the country because of I didn't have anything. I didn't have any ID. I didn't have the 100 points of ID that you needed. And I'd not lived in Australia for so long that everything Australian had expired, so I didn't have what they needed.
You'd forgotten how to tick the boxes.
I was completely, I had no identity, and it took a long time to work out that problem. But I was really happy and I just didn't want to come home. I felt a peace being there, you know, with no other responsibility but, you know, to watch the sunrise every day and, you know, watch the clouds go across and forage for food and try and talk to locals. I also just didn't want to come home and talk to anyone about it because I knew that all the questions would be there on the other side waiting. And I couldn't get them while I was there because of the lack of technology and communication.
And in the end, though, you did come back and it was to Melbourne.
Yeah, I think after you go through an experience like that, I mean, I lost everything. You know, the money I did have, like a pirate, had all in cash on my boat. So everything I had was gone. And I had to obviously work. So I decided, having gone through that experience, that I would do what I actually always really wanted to do, which was be a designer. And I didn't do that when I was younger because of that pressure you get as a kid to do something that you would be successful in and make you a lot of money rather than where your heart really lies. And so I thought, well, whatever, like, we're all going to die at some point, and I nearly did a few times, so I may as well do what makes me happy for work rather than what's going to make me very successful.
I want to bring in Dr. Marnie Lishman here, psychologist. Marnie, explain to us, what is it that stops us, besides the mortgage and the obvious stuff, following our dreams and making big changes in our lives?
Well, basically, it's fear. So we are wired to survive. So yes, we're in the modern world where we're stressed out and we're busy and we're socialised to head on a particular pathway because that's what we've learned is the right thing to do. But we've got we've got 50,000-year-old brains technically, which is wired for perceiving anything in our environment that could be fearful, that could threaten our survival. So we have these primal brains that even just from a thought of something can stop us choosing a particular pathway that might be probably the less sensible. So even in the beautiful story that we've just listened, even I was daydreaming off onto a beautiful island, but I think I think a lot of people, when you hear the word shipwreck, would go straight into fear. And I think anything that we would...
Regardless of the no underwear feature, I mean, that would make anyone terrified.
Oh, my gosh, the bra. Yeah, no.
I don't think I can manage an hour without a bra, let alone a few months on a random tiny island.
Yeah, exactly. So I think a lot of us, we're wired to stay in that comfort zone, even though that comfort zone becomes very uncomfortable. So I think a lot of people, just because in that sort of story, we'd pick out the fearful bits. And we'd just say, no, we could not do that. Anything that involves change or something different that would take us out of our comfort zone, that's often uncomfortable, so much so that we will spend more time whinging about it and moaning about it and being unhappy than actually changing it.
And the irony there, I suppose, is that people would have thought, you know, getting on a sailing boat, but I could end up shipwrecked.
Yeah.
How scary that is. But the reality is for Sarah Andrews, of course, has just explained that ended up getting her to the happy spot.
Exactly.
So as a general rule, Marnie, we do tend to wait for disaster.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of sensible, isn't it? Because if we sit and we think about all the happy, the endless possibilities, how wonderful our life's going to be, we're not going to be prepared for when the bad stuff happens. So that primal brain does serve us very well, but it can lead us to lead quite a discontented life if we don't look out for it. So we're constantly using all the information we know from the past and we're predicting what could happen in the future. So we don't spend very much time in the present. And that's why that story we've been hearing sounds so beautiful, because it sounds like after the initial trauma of it, there was a lot of being in the present, which really all the listeners and everyone, we really need to be steering ourselves into that direction, because we're a stressed and overwhelmed society and we need to start learning to be more in the present moment, which is really going against our wiring as a human species.
And against the pack.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we're pack animals as well. And we're constantly looking at what we've been social. So we're socialized. So we're doing what everybody else does. And that doesn't a lot of the time leave room for what we need as an individual.
Because I think Sarah even mentioned just before that idea of she didn't really want to tell everyone what she was doing, because people look at you like, well, why would you do that?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And there are a lot of dream killers out there. But again, that's for their own protection, isn't it? So we're giving our advice because we're trying to, it's like that fear by proxy. It's like, don't do that. That's not sensible. You're jumping into the fear and we're not quite happy with that. So you'll probably get that from very well-meaning people, but they're just projecting their own fear onto you. And it really takes a really tough person to push through that.
Sarah, was there a fair bit of that?
That idea? Yeah, I didn't tell anybody, you know. I think my parents knew, and that's it. And
what was their response?
I can't remember, to be honest, but I've always been pretty independent. So I think it was just another thing that I was doing that didn't really, were too surprised. They were, you know, obviously a bit distressed when they got the call from the Mexican Navy saying they'd had a distress signal and I was lost at sea, which was on my mum's birthday. But it was also April Fool's Day, so she thought it was a joke to begin with and just hung the phone up. But,
thought one of your nasty friends was playing a prank.
Yeah, but even when I got home, I just, you know, it's only been quite recently that I've been talking to people about it. Because I just don't think they could have ever understood the experience the right way. You know, instead of looking at me like I'm crazy, it was such a beautiful, beautiful experience, I think.
I mean, I suspect a lot of people listening would be thinking, oh, well, the other thing that holds me back, it's not just fear, but it's related to fear, is the financial commitments, the kids, school fees, the big mortgage. So how do we keep this real? How do we incorporate this follow your dreams concept into everyday life?
Yeah, it all sounds well and good, doesn't it, that we'd all be less stressed and less overwhelmed and healthier if we lived on an island. But realistically, yeah, often we can't do that. Maybe going to Bali now and again might cut it, but not so much. But when you think of the concept of ikigai, it's not just the reason we get out of bed in the morning and, you know, the reason for being, and we need to just do all the things that make our life worthwhile every day. There's components of it, and that includes you doing something that you love to do. So actually sitting and thinking about, what do I love doing? You know, those moments where, say, when you're in love or when you're painting or when you're watching a wonderful movie, just when you're in your flow state and life's stopped and you're in the present moment, there's moments of our day that are like that. And we can, it doesn't have to be the big leaps and the big holidays and the big take a year off, because that's quite unrealistic. It's the little things that can keep us in the present moment. It might be gardening for some people, it might be growing your own vegetable garden, walking the dog. Some of these things can only take 10, 15, half an hour. You know, it's not, they're not big leaps that can make such a big difference. And the other thing about ikigai, it's doing things that the world needs, because we are pack animals. And when we're doing something wonderful as a collective or making a difference to other people, we get that positive reinforcement, don't we, in the feedback. And that makes us feel good as well. And again, it brings us to the positive and the present, yeah, happy moments.
Just to remind people as well, the ikigai you keep referring to, this is a Japanese term,
yes.
Translates roughly to that thing that you live for. I think I described it as that thing that gets you out of bed in the morning and pumped to seize the day.
Exactly.
And it shouldn't just be work. But maybe for some people it is work.
Well, for some people it is. And again, part of ikigai is doing something that you can get paid for, because we know when we're not getting any sort of funding into our lives, it can be very stressful. And it's very hard to be in the present moment when we're stressed. So we're constantly future, aren't we? I'm only going to be happy if I get some more money. So you have to have a really balanced mindset. You can't just throw everything away and just head off, unless you have some funds with you that can allow you to survive. But I guess ordinarily, most of us, we need to fund somehow. So part of ikigai is actually doing something that you love, that the world needs, something that you're good at, but also something that you can get paid for as well. So you'll find when you read up on that Japanese concept is a lot of the Japanese people actually will grow a vegetable garden and they get some money for that. So they're doing something they love, but they're helping their community, but they also get some money for it as well. And yeah, I think a lot of us need to know ourselves very well and try and choose a job that time stops for, that we're in our flow state and that we love, because then that's how you're going to get it.
I think for me, that's that hour between 10 and 11 each exactly. weekday, speaking to you, of course. Just speaking to you folks, particularly when we're in the slow lane as we are today. Sarah, you've talked us through this dream life in the Mexican village, and then you came back to Melbourne, find yourself unhappy again. You're flicking through a magazine and you see an ad for a shack for sale. What did that ad say?
It was a little bit piece of the area of Tassie, and it described it as some of the most desolate, remote. It basically described it as one of the most miserable place on earth that no one ever goes to or knows about. And I was like, that's it. That's where I've got to be. Because I was so unhappy in my life. I was forced to come back to Australia, and I was really forced to start again and get another mortgage, and I ended up married, and I headed headfirst back into what I'd managed to get myself out of because of that pack thing that you're talking about. It was so difficult to be back here.
The need to conform.
Yeah, and I did. And I was desperately unhappy again, surprise, surprise, and flicking through this mag and reading about this desolate part of the world that no one ever visits or goes to. And I Googled real estate immediately and found the shack that was pictured in the magazine and was for sale. It'd been on the market for 5 years. No one wanted to buy it. And I just bought it on the spot. And I thought, I wanted to go back to the beach in Mexico, and not that actual beach, but I wanted to go back to a place and know what that time had forgotten, and back to that simple life, and in a bolt hole of the world that no one knew about. So I found it down there and bought it.
You're a real estate agent's dream with impulsive behaviour like that, aren't you?
Well, it wasn't very expensive. I think it was 80 grand. So I thought, well, if it doesn't work out, I could sell it. I didn't think it was a big roll of the dice. And I was so unhappy at that point that I needed to go back to the place in life where I was happy.
And now you've restored the shack, and you have turned it into a money-making enterprise, in a sense of what Dr. Marnie Lishman was just explaining, using, that Japanese term where you can generate income.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was never the plan. My plan was to go down there and renovate it for myself, and I would spend part-time down there and part-time back in Alice Springs where I was living with my wife. Mm. But while I was renovating, and nearly towards the end of it, within the same week, I kind of found out my wife was having an affair, and I had a very serious health condition in days of each other. So my life completely fell apart. I didn't have a home to go back to. I wasn't healthy. I couldn't work. I had no money, cut off from all our family bank accounts. So I found myself back in the same position that I wanted to be in. I didn't really want it to manifest that way. But so what I had to do is use all of my, I guess, smarts and things that I'd learnt over my life in being a creative and being a scientist and being a businesswoman, to turn that shack into the most successful, high-earning, busy Airbnb in the world because I needed to earn money. I needed to pay for lawyers. I couldn't work. And I knew I had to do it quickly and make this end of the earth that no one ever went to the place to go. So I did. And within, a few weeks, I was completely booked out.
What do you think it is that appeals to people about it? The same thing that appealed to you?
Yeah. I think we live in such an unreal world that when something real does come along, it's captivating because we're real and we're humans and we're living in, I think, in a way that's so distant from that me being able to tell my story like through Instagram or different marketing channels, it captures people because I think maybe deep down that's what most people really want, is they want to be happy and free and in nature and maybe a situation that's less complicated than the one that they're in.
Let's get to some texts because I've been asking you this morning if you've done this, if you've got off the hamster wheel, if you've had the big change. And it doesn't have to be a big change, as we've been hearing from psychologist Dr. Marnie Lishman today, that you can incorporate this Japanese term, ikigai, into your everyday life, the idea of that thing that you live for, whether that's going out and, I don't know, taking the dog for a walk or going for a bit of a stroll down to the river each day, whatever it is, you can incorporate it. You don't have to have a huge life change. Of course, Sarah Andrews has, and we're all living vicariously through it. Here's a few texts. Craig in Leederville, I love this one. I gave up a very lucrative career in advertising to become a full-time artist. Poorest I've ever been, but the happiest I've ever been by a long way. Craig, fantastic. I love it. This one, Goldie says, anxiety is a state of being lost in the future. Guilt is a state of being lost in the past. Right now is a gift. That's why it's called the present. And this one, no name on it, but it says, I find I'm very attached to my parents, my friends, my pets and my home. And this keeps me stuck from moving or downsizing and retiring early, which would be a dream. I might get your response to that one, particularly the idea of, you know, money lost in the future. You touched on it before. Mm-hmm. How aware are we? I mean, obviously Goldie's aware, but how aware are we generally that fear is what stops us and that, you know, we can be lost in this, I suppose, saving for the bigger house and the next this and the next that?
Yeah, I just think a lot of people don't realise that that's what it is. I think we stay in our safety zone and that's driven by that primal part of our brains. And the primal brain is informed by everything that we know. And there's so much we don't know. And so we're constantly physiologically in the present using that past to predict the future. And we don't think of the happy stuff. We think of the fearful things because that's what we need to be prepared for and kind of not get into that. We just want to avoid that at all costs. But what we need to do is start spending time in the present moment. So go against our natural wiring and be in the moment, because otherwise fear will steer you in a direction that you probably don't really need to go. And because we're not physically present a lot of the time or mentally present, our body and our brain is constantly whispering to us. That's what our intuition is and you know, that gut instinct. And we often don't listen to it. But if you have that present moment and listen to what's going on, you will be steered in a direction that is just about you. That's why meditation and mindfulness and being in those present moments where you're in your flow state and time just disappears, and when you're in love and things like that, that's where the good ideas come from.
Sarah, for you, is that looking out that shack window?
Yeah, it is. You know, now my life looks different. I travel full time. I don't live anywhere. And, you know, I work, but I love what I do. But, yeah, when I go back there, that's where I am. So
what does it look at like out that window from that shack?
It's like, I don't know, you could, it's like there's no one else in the world. It feels like you're the last person on earth in a good way. So, you know, it's watching the tides come and go and the weather come in and go out and the sun come up and come down. And I've seen the southern lights out that window at the right time of the year. And I've seen dolphins and rainbows and a couple of big seals, lots of interesting things. Once I was sitting in my window and it was misty and I was looking really hard and there was a tall ship in the mist and I thought, oh, that's it, I've lost it. I've really gone off the deep end of insanity, but it was actually, it looked like a ghost ship and I could hear people singing and stuff, but it was actually real. So I hadn't, spending that much time on your own, sometimes you think you're losing it, but it was really beautiful to see.
You turned the shack into a money-making enterprise, and I understand that wasn't the purpose, that wasn't the aim when you did that. Does sharing it give you happiness now?
Yeah, it does, because I didn't think that other people would get it. I thought they would come and be like, it was very clean, the sheets were nice, that sort of stuff. But what I've found is that I think I've had 200 guests now. They have the same experience as I have, which is it's life-changing for them. I've had so many beautiful stories about that they've decided to quit their job while they were there or leave their husbands or all these amazing things. It's the sort of place I think people come to and it tends to reframe their life, and it's incredible some of the stories that have happened there. I don't know what it is about that place, but it does the same thing for other people as it does for me.
And I wanted to know, Dr. Marnie Lishman, you talked about fear. It's holding us back from doing what we want in our lives. You're telling us we need to be more in the present moment, more mindful. If we do know, that sounds really simple if you're a person who's trained yourself to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone knows how to do that, especially maybe they're listening today and they're like, well, I don't know how I do this.
Yeah.
If you're noticing that too much fear is taking over your lives, what are some of the first steps that someone could take?
Well, I think noticing, like having that self-awareness. Are you unhappy? Are you frightened? Are you anxious a lot of the time? So your distress, if your body's not at ease, that's actually telling you something. So have that self-awareness. And then try and be in the present. So use those moments of doing nothing, even if it's just sitting in the moment or walking down the beach or sitting in your garden. Because when you're in the present moment, you start getting informed more about what you actually need. And then just take the small steps. It doesn't have to be the big stuff. When you have those present moments, that's where your brain is telling you or your mind is telling you, you're unhappy in this relationship, maybe you need to take steps to leave it. Or you're unhappy in that job, what else can you do? Or you're not feeling physically healthy, maybe you need to start exercising. When you slow down, your body and your mind will tell you what to do. And then just take those small steps. It might be going on your lunch break, go and have a walk in the garden near your office. Have a date night with your partner to reconnect. If there's so many people out there that are musicians that don't play music, or they're artists that don't do art, or they're ballet dancers that don't dance anymore. Like, do those things. You know deep down what you love to do and what you're good at. Just start doing them in the smallest capacity.
How important was that for you, Sarah?
Yeah, I think I'm lucky enough for my life to have changed dramatically by big events. So, and all the things that I've done that have been quite profound, I essentially was forced into them. They weren't really a choice. They were either at a point of absolute depression or a shipwreck or, a completely failed marriage and a big blow up with that. So I'm very human and I'm not so good at changing my life unless I think something really big does it for me.
All right, we're all guilty of that.
I totally agree with you, because as a psychologist, I see so many people who are going through adversity, and it's almost like if you don't listen to your mind and what it's whispering to you, the universe comes along and gives you something and you're forced out into it. So I often say to people, don't wait for that. Don't wait for that to happen. Don't just go through adversity first, because often adversity, a lot of personal growth always happens through that. But yeah, for people who are listening, do the little things now, just start now, and hopefully it'll avoid the adversive consequences.
We've only got a couple of minutes left before we're going to go to a story of love that might prompt some of us to think even more about what we've been discussing today. You're with Jess Strutt on the Focus program, ABC Radio Perth. A couple of texts have come in. Alan says, hi, Jess. I fear relevance deprivation syndrome, a morbid affliction that pounces at the work-retirement boundary. I've been retired for 10 years and I've been hit by the pain occasionally. Please note, this is a very first world problem, like turning into a feral psychotic werewolf when the magpies lose. This letter has a problem with repeating itself too. Great show. Rock on. Thanks, Alan. That's the difficulty too, making a big life change, even going from being a political reporter, for example, and then doing something different. You have to get new, adjust to the new terms of your life, don't you, Marnie?
Yeah, exactly. And it's the fear of the unknown. We don't like change as a human species, but if you jump into it, there's endless possibilities and it's not the fearful stuff that we predict. Yeah, sometimes that is at the beginning because change does feel weird, like entering a new job, leaving a relationship, not having any money for a period of time. That is very uncomfortable and that's what we fear. But if you push through that, we're very good, actually, when we're in times of stress, we can actually pull ourselves through. And once we get through that, there are endless possibilities that we probably never thought of that we could embark on.
There's another beautiful text. Do what inspires you, which is to be creative. Thank you for that text. Well, today we've been hearing your stories of how you managed to escape the rat race on texts. And, for some it's a bit smaller. And for some it's big, like Sarah Andrews jumping on a sailing ship. The notion of sailing off into the sunset is a little bit cliche, but when a girl called Michelle clapped eyes on a bloke called Jeff, that's exactly what they did. Here's their story. Stick with us.
So he sailed over to Lord Howe Island and I was working there. We instantly hit it off. It was crazy. He and his mate stayed for probably, it wasn't long, it was like 3 or 4 days, did some touring around, what have you. Jeff and I immediately were hanging out together. That was his first trip on his yacht called Larrikin. It was on straightaway. I remember he came up the steps out through the hatch with this big smile, and he had a gorgeous smile, this big smile on his face, his sunnies and his hat, and I just thought, oh, this looks good. And that was it.
And he had the same thought, obviously.
He did. And he had told me that he planned to do these big trips and, not thinking we'd go anywhere further than that. And I left Lord Howe after 8 months, came back to my hometown, started working, and he asked me if I'd like to go over to Noumea with him on the boat.
And what did you think when he asked you that?
Well, I said yes because I wanted to hang out with him. I wasn't very keen on the sailing side of it, and I never thought in a million years my first trip on a yacht would be 10 days out to sea to Noumea with the birds and the dolphins, and that was it. I didn't have much luck with boyfriends and things, and I was older when I met him
In 80s terms.
In 80s terms, yeah, I was 27. I was an old maid.
In 80s dollars.
Yeah.
You were 50.
And my mum would say, oh, don't worry, love, bloom where you planted, someone will turn up. And I'd think, no, I don't think they're going to now. I think I've missed that boat. But, yeah, he did, and he was it. We were two sides of the coin. I was, I don't know. I don't know about this. Shouldn't we be working and planning and getting a house and all the sort of normal, so-called normal things. And he was, no, you just do this sort of thing when you can. This is when it happens. So we did that for 5 years, Amber.
Wow.
Yeah. I found out I was having our first baby when we were coming down the coast from our second trip. And he decided then, we'll work for a little while. And I just used to waitress and he'd build boats. And he decided to build a catamaran and start a business so that we could continue this lifestyle. So we were going to have the family and live on the catamaran and travel. We got married in 1991 and we were back to start. He was starting to build our catamaran then, just after that. So it was late 80s, early 90s. And, yeah, it was all going really well. It was going beautifully and our plans were going beautifully and we started this gorgeous little business here in Batemans Bay and we'd take the catamaran out to the Tollgate Islands, which is a little way out off the bay, and we'd have champagne cruises and sometimes you'd see a whale and people would pay to do that. We couldn't believe it. We were like, this is so easy. This is how you get money, doing what you love. And then one day he got a very bad headache and he was only 39. We had Jack and Harry by then and we used to juggle them around and it was only 3 months we had the business going for when he got sick.
So the headache takes him off to the GP and
the headache takes him actually to the hospital. Harry was a little baby, tiny baby, and Jeff used to get up to him and settle him if he needed it. And he came back to bed one night and said, I have got a headache beyond headaches. I've never felt like this before. It's worse than a hangover. And he never complained about headaches. And I said, oh, well, I think you can go to the hospital and get a needle for that, you know, fix that up. And we waited until the next morning and went up. And Jeff was lying on the bed and this doctor said, you're not telling me everything. A man who never gets headaches has got a very severe headache. You're not telling me everything. And Jeff looked at him and said, oh, I had a melanoma cut out 10 years ago. And that minute, that sentence was when our life exploded. And they raced him up to Canberra to do surgery on his brain, but it was everywhere. And it was only 10 months from that day until the day he died. 9 years doesn't seem like a very long time, and it isn't, but I was on 35 feet of yacht with him 24 hours a day. So really, we had years. You don't get to spend that much time with your husband when you're out working and doing the so-called normal thing, do you? So I did get a lot of time with him.
And time in, like, an incredible place and space, you know?
Amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
That story on Michelle there by Focus producer Amber Cunningham, the critical point, I suppose, to consider. Life's short. Chase your dreams. My big thanks to Dr. Marnie Leishman, psychologist, and Sarah Andrews, designer, masterclass teacher, and Airbnb host for their time today on that latest episode of In the Slow Lane.